Chapter 6. Suffer any ally, because every gun and sword is to be welcomed into your service. Trust no ally absolutely, for every gun and sword may be turned against you. Codex Astartes. Omayan had not expected Frey Sire to survive. The Firecast were useful, but sometimes their greatest utility lay in situations of danger. The Watercast had to balance their immediate benefit against the possibility of using them again in the future, and Vray Sire was far more useful dying to deny the Ultramarines the Generatorium than he was in fighting any future battles that might come along. It was testament to the stubbornness of the Space Marines that even protected by the armor and guns of a Riptide, Vray Sire had not been safe. The Firecast themselves did not understand. Their own commanders tried to preserve their troops, basing decisions on the suboptimal desire to reduce casualties. The Ethereals, infinitely wise though they were also compassionate to a fault. That was why the Watercast had to be trusted sometimes, with the completion of goals whose means were less palatable to the other castes. The Ethereals would bemoan the deaths among all species. The Firecast would rage at the loss of their brethren. But the Watercast would agree that Omayan had done what was necessary for the greater good, and keep the lines of his reasoning to themselves. Omayan had left the city by that point, leading his entourage through the Gwela network of tunnels and safe houses to the cemeteries outside the city limits. There the Gwela had interred their dead, and icons of their strange emperor-worshipping faith scattered the stony hills. The Firecast crouched among the tombstones, blending with the stony ground in their camouflage mantles. The Watercast functionaries huddled around the ambassador as if they were freezing, and his knowledge was warmth. The first streak of fire in the sky did not bring Omayan joy. The Gwela were odd creatures, with their mercurial, tempestuous emotions, their capricious desires and constantly shifting focus. They would find a savage joy that someone they hated was suffering, that they had won a victory against a despised foe. They would whoop and dance and intoxicate themselves as they so loved to do. Omayan had seen this happen in his mind 1,000 times before, and had planned out 100 lines of cause and effect that led to those first explosive starship rounds breaching the upper atmosphere. Any joy had burned out long ago. The first rounds hurtled through the middle and lower atmosphere, accelerated by Briseis's own gravity, and speared into the Chronorites district. A bloom of orange fire rose over the skyline, throwing a cloud of debris into the air. A clock tower toppled, vanishing in a billow of dust. Secondary explosions peppered the rooftops as the volatile chemicals stored in the mechanics' workshops caught fire. The main body of the salvo descended in a slow, burning rain. The people below, the loyal Gwela and ignorant civilians alike, were recovering from the shock of the first impact, and perhaps looking up at the sky to see what disaster would come next. They saw many more disasters, 40 or 50, each one a massive caliber shell fired from a broadside cannon on the Polar Defiance. More explosions blossomed across the Chronorites district. Some shells fell wide and erupted among the lavish housing around the Parliament, or strayed into the industrial or clerks' quarters. How many people died in those moments? The Firecast had calculated the outcome of such a bombardment, but the numbers they came up with had slipped Omayan's mind. It was unnecessary information, irrelevant, shunted aside to make room for something more important. The lives of the Gwela did not matter. The effect the bombardment would have on the survivors was the crucial knowledge, and Omayan knew exactly what it would be. The skyline of the Chronorites district was eroding, its cramped hab blocks and towers collapsing. A spire near the Parliament collapsed, taking with it a meaningless number of the city's aristocracy. The cemetery's tombs were lined red and orange with the glare of the fires ripping up from the city. The sounds reached them. Deep rumblings like an earthquake, punctuated by the sudden gunshots of exploding chemical stashes. "Where is the beauty in this?" asked O'Mayan. The functionary beside him turned to answer.
"In the knowledge of the furtherance of the greater good," he replied.
O'Mayan nodded in agreement, signifying the functionary was correct. These little moments of praise kept the smaller-minded on the right path.
"And thus we reach the pinnacle of our craft," said O'Mayan. "The blissful stage, when all we need to do to see the greater good fulfilled, is wait."
In the hours that passed, the bombardment ceased, long after its purpose in wiping out the strongholds of the loyal Gwela was complete, and the fires spread to other parts of the city. Streams of evacuees left the city gates to form miserable makeshift camps in the flinty hills. None of them strayed near the cemetery, for it was a place of ill omen, and such things held much weight in the imaginations of a society still not far removed from its tribal roots. The clever ones brought supplies with them to set up shelter, and the others crowded around them to absorb better chances of survival. Survivors of the peacemakers tried to police the evacuees, but they had no hope of keeping the peace here. Opportunists were already stealing and settling scores. Thus were the ways of the Gwela. A group of humans approached the cemetery. They were tribal elders, among them the elder of the Thundercliff, who had spoken to O'Mayan many times in preparing this moment. Other leaders were among them, representatives of every ancient tribe of Briseis, guarded by the tribal enforcers who were the true lawkeepers of Port Memnor. They were the leaders of the Endless Sky, the Black Thorns, the Bone Renders, and many more, those peoples who had wandered Briseis before they even learned of a long-dead emperor and his crumbling imperium.
"Why have you chosen this place?"
demanded the Bone Render elder. He was a robust and bearded man, who seemed not to need the protection of the warriors at his side. They carried weapons carved from bone, and he wore the trinkets of tooth and ivory emblematic of his people.
"We will not be watched here," said O'Mayan, "and as you can see, the city is not safe. I have called you together because, in their infinite mercy and generosity, the Tau wish to extend once more their offer to your people. You have heard the terms already, and they are once more laid before you. It is not much we ask, but in return we offer you the greatest gift, a place within the Tau Empire, freedom for your people, a future of your own."
"It is more to ask than you realize,"
said the elder of the Black Thorns. He was a sickly-looking old man, with skin that seemed paper-thin. His attendants carried the implements of his tribe's primitive alchemy, grinding bowls, bundles of rank herbs, jars of insects and leeches.
"To turn back the centuries, to make whole what has so long been broken. Our people live in cities. They kneel before the eagle. Those who keep to the old ways are few. Many will die, alien."
"Your weak will die," said Ambassador O'Mayan. "Is that not the way of Briseis? It was the principle on which your tribes were built. It is our principle, too. It is a part of the greater good to abandon to their fate those who do not deserve to thrive. And you forget. You will not be alone. The Tau Empire will protect you and watch over you, as it does all who pledge themselves to it."
"And we will become strong," said the Thundercliff Elder. "We have been weak for too long. The Imperium has seen to that. One generation is all it will take. It will be hard as the stones and unyielding as the sky."
"And if you fear for the lives of your people,"
said Umayan, "than simply observe." He cast a hand towards the city, the heart of which was spurting clouds of flame and black smoke as it burned. "The Imperium will have their city, and if it be a ghost town inhabited by none but corpses, they will care not. They would herd every Brycean into the fires. There is no turning back. Throw off their yoke, or they will destroy you."
"I say yes to your offer," said the elder of the Storm of Shale tribe. "The Imperium have shown what manner of master they are. I would kneel to the alien 1,000 times before I would once before an Imperial altar."
Other elders gave their assent. A dozen voices raised at once.
"But we once were free," shouted the elder of the Bone Renders. "We will but cast off one slave master for another. I will lead my tribe to destruction before I lead them to servitude again."
The Thundercliff elder shuffled forwards to stand face to face with her Bone Render counterpart. The Bone Render was a big man, obviously powerful and physically dangerous, but the frail old woman before him seemed to make him shrink away, as if she was the true threat.
"War between the tribes," she said, "is a terrible thing. You are charged with keeping the memories of your tribe, so you know it as well as any of us. You speak of leading your people to destruction. Stand before the rest of us, and that is exactly what you will do. Pride keeps you from proclaiming your allegiance to the alien. That is to be expected, for the Bone Renders always were proud. Simply stand in silence, and your will shall be our will."
The Bone Render tried to meet the old woman's gaze, but his eyes turned to the ground instead. The moment passed, and he stayed silent.
"Then it is agreed," said the Thundercliff Elder. "None will stand against. None will make war in the name of pride."
There was no answer from the other elders.
"My gratitude, noble people of Briseis," said Umayan. "From the sadness of this day shall come a great celebration, for you are now united with 100 other species in the embrace of the greater good. But there are urgent matters that must be attended to. Have you brought the scouts we requested?"
The Thundercliff Elder gestured to her entourage, and a dozen men came forward. They wore the colours of several different tribes, hardy souls with pallid and pockmarked skin, brought about by spending too much time underground.
"They have mapped the tombs and tunnels as their fathers did," said the Thundercliff Elder. "None know the underside of Port Memnor as they do. The scouts of the Thundercliff gave you access to the tombs as you requested. And now all tribes have given their expertise. There is no corner of the Undercity they do not know."
"Then I ask that we move immediately," said Umayan. "An earth-cast work detail waits at the tomb entrance. The rest of you, my fire warriors, have prepared a safe place for you, so you might be spared the wrath of the Imperials. For more may soon fall on Port Memnor. They want to wipe you out, but the greater good values your allegiance and will protect you with our own Tau blood."
The fire warriors gathered the elders up and began marching them off the cemetery grounds towards a ridge a short distance away, where another team of Tau troops kept watch. The Bone Render looked back at his burning city, just once, and followed the rest without another word. The Space Marines met at the landing site, where the shuttles from the Polar Defiance had dropped them at the start of the mission. The full Jade Dragons squad was there, barely scratched by their assault on the chambers of Major Skepteris. Divinius, on the other hand, was alone. The Jade Dragon squad was lined up along the ridge when Divinius arrived, standing watch. Sergeant Sianoa was among them, Skepteris's blood still caking his armored boot. Davinius limped down the slope as Cianoa's eyepieces turned to follow him. Davinius took off his helmet and dropped it at his feet. His power sword followed, and he stood unarmed. Cianoa stepped out of line and walked to a few paces from Davinius. He unhooked the power couplings on his lightning claw and placed it on the ground. He removed the magazine from his bolter and laid the weapon beside the claw. He took his helmet off, as Davinius had done. His face was bull-necked and flat-nosed, with the same swirling patterns on his armor inked across his cheeks and forehead. Neither man spoke. Cianoa dropped into a loose guard, hands held up, mobile and fainting. Davinius watched him, unmoving, gauging every detail of the jade dragon's mobility and fighting style. Cianoa was all power and momentum, built for takedowns and grappling, neutralizing an enemy's movement and grinding him into defeat. Davinius had fought 1,000 unarmed bouts against his brother Ultramarines on Macrag, and he knew just about every style of combat a space marine might employ. Cianoa made a move for Davinius's front leg, not a serious attempt to knock him down, but a probing attack to see how Davinius moved. Davinius made the least movement necessary, not giving anything away. Cianoa circled, face focused, making quick half movements with his hands, trying to draw a false start out of Davinius. Cianoa knew he would have to move in first, make the first attack. That was why Davinius made the first move instead, darting inside Cianoa's guard with the speed and focus he had learned in decades of sparring and warfare. He drove a fist into Cianoa's breastplate, knocking the jade dragon off balance. He hooked Cianoa's leg with his own, driving an elbow up into Cianoa's jaw and tipping him onto his back. Cianoa sprawled onto his back in the loose shale. Davinius was on him, driving a fist down at his face. Cianoa caught Davinius's arm in the crook of his elbow and forced Davinius down to the ground. Suddenly the positions were reversed, Cianoa on Davinius's back, wrenching his arm behind him. Davinius felt his injuries, sealed up by the rapidly clotting blood of a space marine, tearing open inside his armor. Hot blood pooled inside his breastplate. Pain rippled up through his chest, met by the cold flood of painkillers dispensed by his armor. They weren't reducing the pain anymore, just turning it from an isolated tearing to a dull pulse of agony that went right through him, as if he was immersed in it. Cianoa wrenched on Davinius's shoulder. The joint was separating. After the encounter with the Tau battlesuit force, it wouldn't take much to put Davinius out of action entirely. Cianoa had 12 ways of beating Davinius now, in a position in which he had a massive advantage. Choke Davinius out. Lock the head and make it clear he could break Davinius's neck at will. Simply pound on Davinius's skull until he fell unconscious. But there was one way for Davinius to regain the advantage. Davinius forced his body around under Cianoa's weight, not fighting against the wrenching on his shoulder, but using all his leverage to pivot in the same direction. He felt tendons snapping and gristle tearing, just before the flood of pain blanked everything else out. His shoulder dislocated, and the joint of his armor was mobile enough to let the bone swivel freely in its socket. No longer pinned in place, Davinius spun on his stomach out from beneath Cianoa. Cianoa was still holding his arm, but it gave him no purchase on Davinius, with the shoulder joint giving no resistance. Davinius was on his feet, turning to face Cianoa. Davinius raised a foot and brought it down on the back of Cianoa's head. His shoulder separated further, but the pain from the injury was just another note in the cacophony soaring through him. He had felt pain before. A space marine had to accept it, to welcome it even, to shunt it to a part of his mind where it could not interfere in the cold business of inflicting harm on the body of an enemy. Cianoa was face down on the ground. Davinius drove a second axe kick into the jade dragon's head, and Cianoa's face slammed into the shale ground. When he lurched up, his face was cut by the flint shards. He tried to reel Davinius back in by the arm he still had hold of, but Davinius dropped, knee first, onto the back of Cianoa's neck and pinned him in place. Davinius drew back the fist of his good arm and hammered it down into the side of Cianoa's face. Pain was bursting through him like fireworks, their glow mingling into a smouldering fire. And it was good. He let it bleed right through him and turn into strength that drove his fist. Bone cracked. Shards of stone clattered against armor. Again and again the fist drove down, and each time it hit a more yielding surface, finding fragments of bone instead of a solid skull, torn mush instead of muscle. Davinius held his fist still, hovering beside his face, ready to hammer down again. The side of Cianoa's face was a bloody mess. A brother did not kill a brother. Cianoa had destroyed the chances of imperial success on Briseis with his rogue mission to kill Skepteris, but he was still a space marine. Davinius could have killed Cianoa there, and both men knew it. Cianoa's squadmates, still watching silently, knew it. That was enough. Cianoa let go of Davinius's arm. It hung limp and senseless by Davinius's side. Davinius got to his feet, and Cianoa lay under him, rolling onto his side and putting a hand to his half-ruined face. Already Cianoa's eye had closed up, and the remaining one looked up at Davinius with hatred he did nothing to disguise. Overhead, the shuttle from the Polar Defiance was descending, its silhouette edged in the glare from its engines against the black sky. The Jade Dragons stayed where they were as the shuttle came down to land, and the ramp opened up. Davinius walked up the ramp alone, and the door closed again, leaving the Jade Dragons on the surface, and the shuttle lifted off to return to orbit. Cianoa clambered slowly to his feet. None of his squadmates helped him. It would be a great shame for Cianoa to show further weakness by accepting the help of a battle brother now. Cianoa picked up his helmet and weapons as the squad stood around him, waiting for their next orders. He jammed his helmet back on, hiding his wounded face.
"As we are hunted," said Cianoa thickly, "so we hunt. The Black Leviathan is here, and there are still aliens to kill."
The Earthcast work party followed their tribal guides through the tombs, deep down among the ancient fissures and uncovered graves with mouldering bones and shattered statues. These were paths known only to the tribesmen and their elders, mapped by scouts who had paid for the knowledge with their lives. It took many hours to reach the lowermost point, where the warrens through the rocky earth merged with the tectonic margin hidden beneath Port Memnor. The Earthcast surveyors had surmised the existence of this fault from orbit when they first prepared for the war on Agrellon, but reaching it had needed the help of the tribes. The tribes had not been willing to give it, and so Omion had been dispatched to do his work, and the web had first been spun. The Earthcast workers were squat and powerful, with heavy hands and muscles made for labor. They hauled with them an explosive charge, sometimes on wheels, sometimes lowered by ropes, finally carried on their shoulders like a steel coffin. The guides who led them did not know for sure what it was, but they could guess. In the infernal heat and the dull glow of the magma-heated rocks, the Earthcast detail unloaded the charge and set it with a timer of 12 hours. They wedged it into a fissure in the rocks, a place where the volcanic heat of Briseis's core met the stony mantle. They made their final checks, and the team leader announced their work was done. The guides were killed with the efficiency on which the Earthcast prided itself. Each Tau had a pistol concealed in his coveralls, and put a single pulse round through the back of each guide's head. The guides had guessed this, too, for if they were captured alive, they might be forced to divulge the location of the bomb and put the whole operation in danger. They did not struggle or complain. They were doing their duty to their tribes, to the family who had raised them and loved them, even when the cold hand of the Imperium had tried to crush out all that made the people of Briseis who they were. Better to die here, with their work complete, than live on another day as chattels of the Imperium. When the last corpse hit the ground, the Tal began the return journey towards the surface. They made good pace, because in 12 hours, there would be no surface to reach.
"Would that I could see this 1,000 times," said Omion. "A 1,000,000 times. So rarely we can observe the greater good advanced. It must be a thought, an emotion. But here, we can see it, and there is nothing more beautiful."
The Tau observer ship had remained hidden among its camouflage fields and the gravitational disturbances around Briseis. The Polar Defiance had missed it entirely. It was not a large craft, just enough to transport Omion's watercast command and the late Vray Sire's firecast carder. It was highly advanced, however, far beyond the technology the Imperium could create, and its bridge was a cold, humming testament to the sleek and efficient science of the Tau. A section of the viewscreen was zoomed in on the city of Port Memnor, focusing on the huge starport that dominated one side of the city with its enormous rock-crete expanses and scattering of control towers.
"The firecast can destroy," said Omion, the watercast functionaries diligently recording his word. "The earthcast can build, and the aircast can take us among the stars. The ethereals can unite us in one glorious whole, a single mind and a single purpose. But only the watercast can bring about such beauty."
The tectonic charges laid by the earthcast had detonated some time before. The sequence of events, of one landmass moving against another, was as carefully planned as the chain of cause and effect that had seen the Space Marines defeated and the tribes of Briseis broken. Now the sequence reached the surface. Port Memnor lurched, and the first buildings fell. The burning scars left by the Imperial bombardment blossomed into flame again, and the tallest structures toppled. The spires around the Parliament itself, the towers of the Generatorium. 1,000 disasters unfolded at once. Those who had not left the city already perished in their thousands. Half the city rose up like a sea monster from an ocean, like the black leviathan with which the jade dragons were so usefully obsessed. The other half sank as if under an enormous weight. The fissure opened. A great black slash ripped across the city, and hundreds of buildings vanished, crumbling to dust and pitching into the depths. The fissure reached the spaceport, and one of the landing pads was torn in half, control buildings falling, explosions erupting where underground fuel tanks were breached. It took almost an hour to unfold. The fault line under the city opened up, and fully half of Port Memnor vanished. The rest devastated more thoroughly than 100 Imperial bombardments could manage. The spaceport was completely destroyed, only burning islands of rockcrete remaining between a crazed pattern of crevasses. Ambassador Omion watched it all, not speaking or even blinking, as the greater good was done before his eyes. When it was done, and only the stubbornly burning fires still moved, Omion turned to the gathering assembled at the back of the bridge. The elders of Briseis's tribes had watched in silence, stunned by the enormity of destruction.
"It is done," said Omion. "You are free members of the Tau Empire. Your people will no longer serve as pawns of the Imperium, serving them to maintain a foothold for their war on Agrellon. You finally have the liberty to seek out the greater good. And the crew have prepared berths for you on board for the time being, but soon you will rejoin your people and lead them in the old ways again,
as nomads and tribes of Briseis, honoring the ancient traditions you preserved for so long. Aircast crew began leading the elders off the bridge, towards the heart of the ship. One did not move, the Bone Render elder, and he stepped forward as the aircast tried to direct him away.
"Speak the truth, alien," said the Bone Render. "Will any of us leave this ship?"
Two Firecast warriors stepped in front of Omion, pulse carbines in hand. The Bone Render did not argue further, and joined his fellow elders as they were escorted off the bridge. Omion waved a hand, and the view screen shifted to show the wide view of Briseis and a gremlin hanging behind it. He was done with this world. A compliance detail would land there soon with Watercast social engineers and Firecast enforcers to make something useful out of the displaced peoples of Briseis. That was beneath Omion's concern. There were other worlds, other species on whom to do his work and leave his legacy. Other worlds on which to pursue the greater good. Perhaps he would even start to believe in it.